I do think that this is misguided. I think that this is absolutely transparent in terms of its political nature.
The Alaska congressional delegation weighs in against tapping the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 23rd. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a court hearing on whether Bristol Bay residents should vote on an initiative aimed at the Pebble Mine.
I think it's entirely appropriate for the people of Lincoln Peninsula Borough to say, we will not trade our salmon for gold. We will not trade our salmon for these sorts of activities.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Alaska's congressional delegation is unilaterally dismayed at President Obama's decision today to tap into the nation's emergency oil reserves. The White House announced this morning that it's responding to tightness in the oil markets by releasing 30 million barrels of crude. The U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve is located in salt caverns off the coasts of Texas and Louisiana and is accessed only sparingly. Alaska's congressmen and senators say, despite the recent higher prices at the gas pump, it's not time to use the emergency oil.
Dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. This is so anti-American independence, anti-American that I've ever seen.
I do think that this is misguided. I think that this is absolutely transparent in terms of its political nature. I think that that is quite disturbing.
I don't know who gave him advice. I wouldn't have given him this advice. This is not a good idea because it's just short term.
That was Congressman Don Young and Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich. Despite the fact that Begich sits on the same Democratic side of the aisle as the White House, he's pushing to drill more oil wells in Alaska rather than using up the saved supply.
I mean, Alaska is, in my view, America's strategic oil reserve, and that's what we should be working on. These little band-aid approaches where they just say, we're going to sell off 30 billion barrels of oil. That's not going to do it. That's just a moment in time. 2 months from now, we'll have a discussion. We won't even know what happened in the price of the fuel at the pump because it won't have an impact.
Today, a senior White House official said the Obama team is not making predictions about whether gas prices will go down from their action. Oil prices did plunge today when the news broke. The White House says relying on the nation's oil reserves is necessary because of the restricted supply of light, sweet crude coming from Libya, especially in anticipation of the heavy summer driving season. The strategic oil reserves contain more than 700 million barrels of oil, and the Obama administration plans at this point to tap less than 5% of that. This will be only the third and the largest sale of the strategic reserves since they were created after the Arab oil embargo of the 1970s. Alaska's congressional delegation also reacted with some concern today about just what the president's planned drawdown of troops in Afghanistan will mean for Alaskan soldiers. They want assurances it's done in such a way that does not leave the remaining American forces high and dry, APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Senator Lisa Murkowski heard a direct pledge from Defense Secretary Robert Gates last week that troops in Afghanistan will not get short shrift as the drawdown takes place. But she's still hearing worried questions from Alaskans, especially around Fairbanks.
The Stryker Brigade from Fort Wainwright was going in right as things were starting to hit the most difficult time going into the summer season. And so the families are anxious. And then when they hear the news that, well, there's going to be this drawdown, this pullout of certain numbers, and they're thinking, wait a minute, my loved one just went over there. He's going to be there for a full year. They're going to be pulling out all these other troops. And does this put him or her in a more precarious situation than otherwise?
One wife with questions is Nikki Withington. She lives in Fairbanks and her husband just deployed to Afghanistan. She doesn't want budget cuts or drawdowns to put him in added danger.
Well, I think the Stryker Brigade is very capable of taking care of themselves. It is their job after all. But I do think that the less troops there are there, not even just necessarily American troops, the less of a presence, the less safe they will be.
Withington says she believes progress has been made in Afghanistan, and so a drawdown makes sense. But she fears this may be too much too soon, and she wants the nation to turn its attention to the war and the soldiers fighting it.
Everyone is also concerned about the big government spending, and everyone is thinking, like, they want the troops home, and Obama sees it as also a way to cut back on how much spending the DOD is doing.
It's concerns from Alaskans like Nikki that have the attention of the congressional delegation. They're all grappling themselves with what should be done in Afghanistan. Senator Murkowski, for example, admits she doesn't know what the perfect number of troops is to keep in country. She says the president's plan to pull out 10,000 troops this year and 30,000 by next summer is a compromise, and she doesn't claim to know better.
I know that people in this country are war weary. I too am war weary. I go out to Walter Reed and I talk with the men who have given so much, not their life, but many of them their limbs. I hear their resolve and their commitment, but I look at the price that is being paid, and then the gains that we hope we are making. And as a policymaker, I want to be sure that we are there for the right reasons.
Senator Mark Begich threw his support to President Obama's drawdown plan and said he wishes more troops could come home, but thinks the decision was based on strategy rather than politics. To hear Congressman Don Young talk, disentangling from Afghanistan is necessary, the sooner the better, a unique opinion among Republicans.
But eventually we're going to have to get out of there. I mean, I just don't see it being successful. Like I said, you go back to history, you've never been successful. I feel sorry for those that lost their lives, families that lost their loved ones for this effort put forth. But when it first started, there's a lot different than in Iraq, and it's a different war entirely.
Army wife Nikki Withington knows that in modern history, no one has conquered Afghanistan and no outsider tamed it. But she disagrees that the war cannot be won, although she says it's hard to know exactly what victory would be. She says it's not like World War II, which ended with definitive winners and losers. And Withington says it's hard to know just who to listen to from Washington and who will do the best by the soldiers.
There's going to be so many drastic claims and promises made over this next year from potential candidates for the presidency and from President Obama himself that I'm not sure what to expect from them as far as defense spending and the drawdown is concerned. I don't really know what to believe because I know some things they claim just aren't possible.
For now, Withington looks forward to her husband's updates from Kandahar and makes time to listen to the policy discussions that affect them both. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Legislative leaders today began distributing draft legislation that, if enacted before the end of the day next Thursday, would extend the state's coastal management program. The next step is a poll of all members to see if 40 House and Senate members agree to call themselves into special session to deal with the issue. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Legislative attorneys have been working on the draft bill since Tuesday, when Senate President Gary Stevens and House Speaker Mike Chenault began to discuss options that might allow the program to continue. The bill is basically the same as one that was approved by a conference committee, but failed in the House on the last day of the special session last month. However, two issues have been changed that members say caused the House to reject it. First, members of the newly created Coastal Policy Board could only be removed for cause, no longer at the pleasure of the governor. The draft bill then defines for cause as neglect of duty, incompetence, inability to serve, misconduct, poor attendance, or lack of contribution to the board's work. The bill also resolves the conflict over deference given to local knowledge versus scientific evidence. It does away with both of them. Instead, it says that coastal development issues must be decided on what's called aggregate evidence, defined to include scientific data as well as human knowledge. House Speaker Mike Chenault says they both matter.
Local knowledge is important and scientific data is important, so why should they compete against each other? Why not look at the whole thing and make a rational decision based upon all input?
Chenault recognizes that there are members who have strong opinions on either side of the program. He says he's open to hearing their suggestions, but he anticipates polling members over the weekend to determine whether to call a special session. The same procedure is being followed in the Senate. Chenault says finding agreement between the House and Senate has not included getting a commitment from the governor or the administration. Although the speaker says he's talked to the governor several times, he doesn't know if the bill will be vetoed if the legislature passes it.
It's the legislature's job to propose legislation, and if it's something that's just egregious with the governor, then he has the veto power. And so that'll be his choice whenever we get when and if we get to that point.
One section of the bill has not been drafted, a description of how to bring the program back from its near-death experience. Chenault says that involves federal issues, and staff is researching the points that'll need to be considered. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, cruise ship traffic to Unalaska dwindles.
I had a woman tell me that we are more expensive than Tokyo, the most expensive city in the world.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The U.S. Department of Justice filed a complaint today against Unalaska and the state of Alaska on the EPA's behalf, charging that the city repeatedly violated the Clean Water Act between 2004 and 2010. The complaint lists over 4,800 violations. The DOJ alleges that the city frequently exceeded its discharge permit and released pollutants, including partially treated sewage, into Unalaska Bay. According to the complaint, the city could be held liable for over $100 million, more than $30,000 per violation per day. The city is in the process of securing funding for a new wastewater treatment plant in order to comply with federal regulations. While the current plant is only 11 years old, it doesn't conduct secondary treatment of wastewater. Unalaska Mayor Shirley Marquardt says that at the time of construction, that plant was covered by an amendment to the Clean Water Act that set more relaxed requirements for some Alaska villages. But Marquardt says that when the city applied for a new discharge permit in 2004, they did not receive another waiver.
Our surprise was that when the permitting responsibility for Unalaska's treatment permit was transferred from EPA to the state of Alaska and what was called primacy, that EPA made very strong signals that the only wastewater permits that DEC could allow would be for secondary treatment, which of course completely upends this 30-year policy.
The EPA would not discuss the pending litigation. The DOJ could not be immediately reached for comment. The Pebble Limited Partnership challenged the Lake and Peninsula Borough's approval of the Save Our Salmon initiative in an Anchorage court this morning. The hearing is just the latest in a battle over the development of a massive gold, copper, and molybdenum mine in southwest Alaska. KDLG's Daisha Eaton has more.
Pebble's attorney Matthew Singer argued that the borough was overstepping its authority in approving the SOS initiative for the ballot.
We contend, Your Honor, that the assembly cannot pass the SOS initiative as an ordinance because the borough charter and the borough's existing ordinances require input from the Advisory Planning Commission, and that a adoption of a new land use policy must be stated first in a modified comprehensive plan.
Singer said the initiative, if sent to the ballot, would effectively be zoning by initiative, which he says violates the state's constitution and is ultimately unenforceable. On the borough's side, attorney Aisha Bray argued that the SOS initiative did not violate the Constitution and that the borough had correctly approved the initiative for the ballot.
The clerk really cannot make the judgment calls and the fine delineations in this pre-election review that Pebble is asking the court to make. That's a lot to put on a clerk and a borough, and it kind of demonstrates the fact that you have all three of us here today and we can all present different arguments on this, that there is no controlling authority, that this ordinance is definitely unenforceable as a matter of law.
The SOS initiative was proposed this spring by the citizens group Alaskans for Bristol Bay, who gathered more than 300 signatures in support of getting it on the ballot. There are 1,165 voters in the borough, which is located southwest of Anchorage along the Alaska Peninsula and encompasses 7,125 square miles of land and dozens of streams and rivers that serve as the spawning ground for the largest runs of salmon in the world, those that return to Bristol Bay. The initiative would amend the borough's development permitting code to prevent the development of any large-scale resource extraction activity, including mining, which would destroy or degrade salmon habitat. The effort by the citizens in the Lakin Peninsula Borough is just the latest in several attempts to stop or slow down development of the Pebble deposit. Those attempts include a statewide voter initiative that was rejected and the recent request by several tribal and fishing entities to have the EPA step in and preemptively use its veto authority under the Clean Water Act. Attorney Scott Kendall represented Alaskans for Bristol Bay at the hearing. He argued that stopping the initiative would disenfranchise the Alaska Native population of the region by taking away their right to vote on a development that would impact their traditional subsistence lifestyle.
The population of the Lakin Peninsula Borough is approximately 70% Native Alaskan. These are people who, many, live a subsistence lifestyle, and the initiative is not a matter of their political preferences. It's a matter of their survival or the survival of their way of life. They have a right to vote on that.
Outside the courtroom just after the hearing, Kendall said Alaskans for Bristol Bay want one thing, to vote on the future of the land that supports the fish with which they're so closely connected, salmon.
This initiative does not prohibit any mine. It doesn't prohibit any lumber sale. It doesn't prohibit extracting gravel. It prohibits one thing. It prohibits destroying salmon habitat. If they're saying, if by their arguments they're saying they can't get their gold out without destroying salmon habitat, I think it's entirely appropriate for the people of Lakin Peninsula Borough to say, we will not trade our salmon for gold. We will not trade our salmon for these sorts of activities.
Singer, Pebble's lawyer, said it's more complicated than that and that justice won't be served by a vote on such a controversial issue.
Alaska law establishes a process for comprehensive land use planning, and that involves a thoughtful, reasoned approach to land use development that includes a role for a planning commission of citizens for review by the assembly of a comprehensive plan for how to develop the borough. So picking off one hotbed issue for an up and down vote is just inconsistent with the legal framework that governs how we plan for land use in Alaska.
Bray, the borough's attorney, maintained the clerk for Lake and Penn was correct in certifying the initiative for the ballot.
She looks for clear authority that it would violate any laws or statutes or the Alaska Constitution. And if there are none, then she certifies it to go forward for signatures. They have the signatures, so then it would go forward on the ballot.
Despite the court challenge, the Lakin Peninsula Borough is pushing ahead with plans for the initiative to appear on the municipal election ballot this fall. A ruling is expected in 2 to 3 weeks. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Two hikers are safe after getting lost on Mount Healy near Denali National Park. The Park Service reports that the women headed out Tuesday night from the park's highway with plans to head up Bison Gulch to the top of Mount Healy and possibly on to Savage River. Park spokeswoman Chris Pfister says the pair of 22-year-olds ran into trouble when the weather soured above the tree line.
The clouds came in and it was raining and they became disoriented because they were up in the clouds.
Pfister says the hikers, seasonal tourism employees from the lower 48, were able to alert authorities they needed help Wednesday morning via cell phone. She says a search that included a ground team, plane, and a National Guard helicopter was unable to locate the pair on the mountain.
They were high enough up that even with bright colors, and they had gotten out, I think, a tan so that it could use as a reflective device, we still couldn't see them. And so about 6 o'clock, they decided that they would try to descend and try to get out on their own.
Pfister says the hikers struggled down several miles through heavy brush to a creek bed where they were found and flown out by the National Guard helicopter crew early this morning in good condition.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NEA Alaska, promoting excellence in public education for Alaskan children through investment in education professionals. Online at neaalaska.org. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again is making the best decision for herself and her baby. The mother has a better chance of regaining health and energy between pregnancies, and her baby has a better chance of being born on time and at a good weight. Talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Alaska has fewer environmental monitors on cruise ships this year. State officials say enough ocean rangers remain to do the job, but critics are worried. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Alaska voters created the Ocean Ranger program when they passed the Cruise Ship Initiative in 2006. It had a test run the following summer and began full operations in 2008, checking on wastewater, air quality, food safety, and other possible problem areas. About 27 environmental monitors were hired that year to ride cruise ships as they sailed Alaska waters. That number was down to 21 last year. State Cruise Ship Program Manager Rob Edwardson says this season, only 16 rangers will be on the big ships.
The coverage rate this year will probably go down to about 70%.
And what has it been in previous years?
Around 90%.
The program, run by the Department of Environmental Conservation, is funded by a $4 fee charged to each cruise ship passenger. Edwardson says staffing is down in part because fewer ships and passengers have been sailing state waters.
The Ocean Ranger program is run with the revenues that come in from the Ocean Ranger fee. So if there are fewer voyages, then there are fewer fees. So we have less available to run the program on.
2 years ago, when passenger numbers were higher, the program brought in about $4 million. That dropped to about $3.4 million last year. Edwardson says it may go up a little this season, but he says costs have also increased. Last year, cruise ships charged the state an average of about $1,680 for ranger berths. That's expected to rise to about $1,800 this year. Fares have increased industry-wide. The revenue and expense changes mean those rangers who are left will spend less time on some ships.
In previous years, just because of the scheduling, ocean rangers have ridden from Vancouver and Seattle on a lot of voyages, and they can't perform their duties until they're in Alaskan waters. So if we switch them in Alaskan ports, then they don't have to be on the voyages for those unproductive days.
The reductions have some program backers worried. One is Joe Geldof, a Juneau attorney who was part of the effort to put the program on the ballot.
I am concerned, and I think I, along with anybody else who uses the marine waters of Alaska, should be concerned because there is less active enforcement of Alaska's water quality now that the department's cutting back on the deployment of ocean rangers.
He points to other parts of the cruise ship initiative that have been scaled back. Stronger water quality rules have in part been delayed, and the $46 per passenger head tax for infrastructure and other shore improvements was reduced to just under $20 for most people starting this season. The Department of Environmental Conservation's Edwardson says every year sees differences, but he says his agency is still committed to environmental monitoring. The Alaska Cruise Association, which represents the lines, was not available for immediate comment. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
An Australian cruise ship on its inaugural voyage stopped over in on Alaska this week on its way to Russia and Japan. Cruise ship landings are becoming more and more rare in the remote Aleutian community. KUCB's Jacob Resnick reports.
Oh, there's a bald eagle just sitting beautifully on the...
77 Australians decked out in matching red parkas were not inconspicuous as they spent the day touring cultural and historic sites around Unalaska. The passengers were from the 289-foot Orion II, a 50-suite cruise ship docked at Dutch Harbor, and they're on their way to Petropavlovsk on Russia's Kamchatka Peninsula. The passengers split into groups and toured museums, went birdwatching, and stopped at the Russian Orthodox Cathedral. Among them was passenger Rob Tuckett from the east coast town of Byron Bay. He said the group started in Vancouver, B.C.
We all flew over from Australia, got on board, and we've been wending our way up for the last 2 weeks.
through all the icebergs and the glaciers and whatever. Been to Geographic Harbour, Kodiak. We're here for a day and then we just work our way down the Aleutians and then across to Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky. That's the one. in Russia, and then do the Kuril Islands for a week, across to Sakhalin Island, Korsakov, and then down to Sapporo in Japan.
Cruise ship landings in Unalaska are limited to only a few a year and have been on the decline, says Elisa Sensky, the executive director of the Convention and Visitors Bureau. This year, the Orion 2 is one of only three scheduled for the year.
That's a very light number. I've been doing this for 3 years now. My first summer, I had 14. Last year, I had 4, and this year, only 3.
But she says she recently received word from the Southwest Alaska Municipal Conference that there may be a new line interested in Unalaska.
I just actually, Swampsea, a representative, contacted me. There is a smaller cruise ship line looking to tap into the Alaska market, into our quaint little city, so we fit the profile. And so next year, it looks like 2012 and 2013, we'll start building the number of cruise ships again.
It's challenging to bring cruise ships to the port of Dutch Harbor. That's not only because of the limited organized activities for cruise ship passengers, but also the high cost of doing business in the Aleutians.
It's tough for us because a lot of vessels, they'll call and they'll say, okay, well, this is what we want. Give me a quote. Well, I'll give them their quote. And I had a woman tell me that we are more expensive than Tokyo, the most expensive city in the world. And I tried to explain to her, you know, I'm sorry that this is what it costs to do business here. And that was us. I mean, we don't make money doing this. And it's always hard to negotiate pricing because, I mean, we say this is how much transportation is. This is how much our venues are. Take it or leave it.
The economic impact to the community is limited. But Sensky says there's value in bringing visitors here who will spread the word to others that Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, is a worthwhile place to visit.
We don't make a lot of money off a cruise ship, but just enough to, pay our venues, pay our transportation, and just show them what we have to offer.
The tour wrapped up with visits to the World War II Museum and the Museum of the Aleutians. The visit also gave passengers their last chance to do some shopping in the United States before heading for Russia in what's scheduled to be a 24-night voyage across the North Pacific from Canada to Japan. In Unalaska, I'm Jacob Resnick.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez and Jacob Resnick in Unalaska, Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor is Annie Feit, our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com.
How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.